1898, Marquis Huzhou has offered our distinguished listees the opportunity to set themselves apart through our print publications. Now, Marquis Radio offers these illustrious professionals the chance to shine in our one-on-one interviews. My guest today is Arthur Sippo, who is a medical director of the St. Louis office of Aetna Incorporated. How are you doing today, Arthur?
I'm doing very well, Charlie.
I'm glad to hear it. Why don't you start by telling us how you got your start in the medical profession?
Okay. I went to college, St. Peter's College in Jersey City, New Jersey. It's now St. Peter's University. I got a degree magna cum laude in chemistry, and I had always had an interest in medicine and biology, so I decided that I would pursue a course in medicine from there. Both of my parents were educators, and actually scientific educators. My mother was a chemist who taught chemistry in high school, and my father was teaching physics and general science in another high school. And he eventually went on to get a doctorate in education from NYU. From St. Peter's, I went down to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee for my medical degree. I completed that course in 1978 and went on to Walter Reed Army Medical Center, where I did my internship. At the conclusion of that, I went to the Fort Campbell, Kentucky Army Base, where I was a flight surgeon for 2 years. During that time, I was with the 1st Brigade, and I did several things, some of which I really shouldn't talk about. But, you know, I had the opportunity to travel to Egypt with the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force exercises back in 1980, completed that course. At the end of it, I did an after-actions report which criticized the current field studies that they had available and the CIA area paper that they had on file at Fort Campbell. The powers that be took notice of this, and they asked me if I was interested in getting a residency in aerospace medicine. This is a particularly military specialty which deals with the problems of aviation, to include things like G-forces, hypoxia, the problems that pilots undergo piloting an aircraft, especially under stressful circumstances. I elected to do this, and I went to Johns Hopkins for a master's in public health in 1981. And then after that, I went down to Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, to the Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine. I spent a year down there. Upon completing that, I was sent to Fort Rucker, Alabama, for being a researcher at the U.S. Army Aeromedical Research Lab. I eventually became the director of the Biodynamics Research Division at the laboratory. I stayed there until 1986, when I was offered the chance to be an exchange officer with the British Army, filling one of their billets at the RAF Institute of Aviation Medicine in Farnborough, England. I went there, and we got married, and then went to England, so it was kind of like an extended honeymoon, at least that's what I tried to convince my wife of. And I worked there until the end of 1989, at which point I was offered a position as a partner in an occupational medicine firm, the Occupational Care Consultants of Toledo. I then left active duty service and went into the National Guard. I spent 11 years in the National Guard, and I started out as a staff surgeon on the 145th MASH out of Camp Perry, Ohio. I eventually became the commander of the MASH a couple of years later. After that, I was sent down to Columbus to be the assistant state surgeon. That job involved reviewing all of the physicals that were done every year. We had 40,000 National Guardsmen in Ohio, so I got to do hands-on a review of all 10,000 physicals every year. I did that for the next few years. Upon the completion of my time there, with the change in the market up in Toledo, I took a job as an emergency room physician down in Sparta, Illinois, and I've worked in several of the areas in southern Illinois right outside of St. Louis. Eventually, I started up an occupational medicine clinic at St. Joseph's Hospital in Highland, Illinois, and I began doing some second opinion work for the attorneys in the area on several issues, especially questions on asbestos causality and some of the problems, analysis really of the medical condition of people with asbestos disease and I still am doing some of that work periodically. I've also done some emergency room medical legal consultation work as well. And this is my second year now as a medical director with Aetna. There are several of us here. One of them is actually my brother, who is a general surgeon, and I've been working here ever since.
So that's quite a lot to unpack. I guess my first question would be, when you started your work in medicine, did you envision that your career would be so closely intertwined with the military?
I was under military scholarship in college and in medical school, and it had been my initial intention to be a full-time military physician for my career. I had started out in a high school in New York, Xavier Military Institute, which was junior ROTC, and I progressed through that, through regular ROTC, and then onto the postgraduate program. And I love the military, still do. I miss it. But I've gotten a little bit too old to do that kind of stuff anymore. But yeah, I really enjoyed the military, and I was very happy to be working in an environment where I wasn't going to have to be worried about medical care costs so much. I could provide care for patients without having to worry about the bottom line in the military system.
So could you tell us a little more about aerospace medicine and how your work contributed to that?
Sure. Aerospace medicine is a specialty under the American Board of Preventive Medicine that deals with the specialized issues related to aviation. And it is mostly a military specialty. There are some aerospace people working with the space program. The space program is a very highly politicized program. And as a result, their emphases are in other areas. You know, we try and provide support for it. I actually worked on rescue and egress for the shuttle program in the mid-80s and worked a couple of the launches. I almost worked the launch when the Challenger had a disaster on liftoff. But they had called for me to go down to the Cape, but unfortunately I was in Oklahoma running a project for the U.S. Army Artillery Board at the time, and I was unavailable. But the things that we usually do is to give special support to pilots. There are medical conditions that don't pose any major threat to ordinary citizens going about their business, but in aviation, they can be a very big problem. They can make it difficult for somebody to continue to function as a pilot or even as a crewman. And you have to worry about, amazingly, one of the big problems we have is this, particularly in the Air Force and in the Navy, are bends in the pilots, where they have bubbles of nitrogen in the blood that can cause, you know, can block the flow of blood and cause pain and damage, can even cause strokes. It's not very well known, but the Air Force has more diving chambers to bring people down to depth to make the bubbles shrink than the Navy does, because it's a much larger problem for them. Other things are hallucinations. Accident investigation did quite a bit of that while I was at Fort Rucker. While I was at the aeromedical lab, I also sat on the consultants panel for the Surgeon General in aviation medicine, where we would determine the fitness for duty for pilots who had had serious medical conditions.
How would you treat some of these conditions?
Well, some of them would require, first and foremost, grounding for safety reasons, and then making sure that you use particular medical treatments that will not interfere with a pilot's awareness. You know, one of the big things at that time was antihistamines, because we didn't have the antihistamines we have today, which do not cause which cause sleeping, and this could affect their attention to duty and their ability to make judgments. It was interesting. The antihistamine Selvane was first approved in the late 80s. But when we got a hold of it and we reviewed all of the literature, we felt that Selvane represented a serious threat to cardiac conditions, that it could lead to arrhythmias and other kinds of heart problems that would incapacitate pilots. So we did not allow our pilots to use it. Selvane was the first of the antihistamines that didn't make you sleepy. And so everybody else was using it. We were not. As the newer generation of antihistamines came on board about 10, 15 years ago, they took Selvane off the market, and they actually said it was because of the cardiac problems, which we had noted almost 20 years earlier. So that's one of the things that we do. Other things, when you're a flight surgeon, as I was at Fort Campbell, you're expected to be an integral part of the unit, You're expected to know the pilots, you're expected to fly with them, and to be able to make sure that they are fit for duty. You know, the commander is really depending on the flight surgeon to understand the unit and to give advice concerning the pilot's fitness for duty. I also was asked sometimes when we went to Egypt, I had to do public health advice on, you know, how to handle water, what we should be doing as far as eating local foods, things like that. So I was giving advice to the commander. You know, luckily, when I was in medical school, I had taken a few courses on tropical medicine. I did the same at Johns Hopkins later on, so that I was reasonably well informed on this stuff, and I could give the bosses good information. That came in handy, too, when I was critiquing the area survey that the CAA had given us.
Were you ever trained to fly?
Well, we always have contact training. I was not in the group that actually was taken to fly, though I have flown the helicopter, and I've had a couple of incidents where the fact that I was flying the helicopter kind of saved us from having a big disaster. I had one time where a pilot and I were flying out to Ocean City. This was when I was at Johns Hopkins, and I was behind the controls, and it was at dusk, and everything was dark, and all of a sudden we popped into the clouds. I immediately went down on instruments, and I told the pilot that I'd lost all visual reference outside the aircraft, and I asked him if he wanted me to turn the helicopter around and fly back azimuth on the compass. And he said, well, no, I'm the pilot. This is instrument flight regulations. I should have the controls. I said, okay, you have the controls. And I transferred to him, and he started diving to the ground. And as this is going on, I'm saying to myself, well, you know, he's the pilot. He knows what he's doing. And then he came over the intercom, help, I'm disoriented. So luckily, I had gone on instruments and it stayed on them, and I was able to right the aircraft. In fact, it happened very quickly. It was probably only about 10 seconds or so. So I didn't even have time to get scared. And I, you know, got the helicopter under control, and I turned back azimuth on the compass and headed back toward Fort Meade. It was interesting because I had heard about what disorientation does to pilots actually in the field when they lose visual reference and they try flying by the seat of their pants. Not a good idea, because your body doesn't have the right senses to really understand what's happening. That's why you need your instruments. And I watched as the pilot was completely unable to see anything inside the cockpit for 10 minutes. If he had been by himself, or if the other person who was with him had not been on instruments and I was also disoriented, we would have been dead.
So in terms of your work in medicine, do you consider yourself to be a more patient-focused physician or more research-focused?
Well, a large part of my work has been in the research arena and in administrative support of aviation medicine. I did keep up my medical credentials. I worked in the acute minor illness clinic when I was at Fort Campbell. Also, we all took a turn down in the emergency room at Fort Campbell. I worked at a troop medical clinic during the day in my initial days as a flight surgeon. So, I also moonlighted when I was at the lab. In order to keep my clinical skills up, I would work in emergency rooms. So I was doing full-time medical research, plus I was working emergency rooms on the weekends to keep the clinical skills up. When I went to England, I acted as a flight surgeon for the U.S. Air Force bases at RAF Lincoln Heath and RAF Alconbury, because I was a residency-trained physician in aerospace medicine. The Air Force guys loved that, because RAMs, as we're called, residents in aerospace medicine, are few and far in between. And those guys were always flying off and going somewhere and doing a mission and taking the flight surgeon with them. And so I would tell them, you pick the day in the month when you need somebody to man the aerospace medicine clinic, because you're going to be shorthanded, and I'll be there and I'll fill the gap. And that worked out very well.
So if you could only pick one area of medicine to work in, research or working directly with patients, which would you pick?
That is a tough one, because I liked them both. To be honest, I love taking care of patients. I was able to do some things in aerospace medicine and the research end that led to important changes in policy. And I think that's probably where some of my lasting accomplishments are. So I would, I'm really kind of torn between the two, but I think the research is more my line.
Can you go into any detail about those policy changes, or are they more along the lines of those histamine work of histamine recommendations you made earlier?
Well, the really big one came as a result of the fielding of the Apache helicopter back in the late 80s. While I was at the aerospace research lab, they were fielding the Apache helicopter, and someone had convinced them that they could fit 99% of all pilots with two helmet sizes. Well, they found out that they couldn't even fit 50%, and there was a big problem, and they asked for help, and I got involved, and eventually I was able to determine that they had used the wrong anthropometric series for determining helmet sizes and that they needed to have a larger sized helmet. And I lobbied heavily for this, but it was to no avail because I was asking to spend another $1 million to develop a new helmet. The helmet was, I have to say, it wasn't just a helmet. It had electronic sensors on board and various devices to slave both the sensory devices and the weaponry. So that helmet had to fit precisely, perfectly every time so that they could use it to fly the aircraft. They would get information on flight information projected into their eye with what we call the eye heads helmet. At that time, it cost about $25,000 a piece. They're probably more like $50,000 now. In any case, I determined we needed a larger size. I was eventually able to convince the Army that they needed to spend the extra money, and I did it in kind of a surreptitious way. We looked to find, because we were doing all the helmet fitting on these guys when they came in to train, and there was one gentleman who came in, his head was utterly enormous. It did not fit inside the helmet, and we would have had to cut the helmet up and refix all the parts in it, and that would compromise the crash worthiness and some of the protection of it. So I disqualified him because of anthropometric incompatibility with the equipment, and this whole thing rumbled up and down the chain. I was lucky that all of my aerospace medicine bosses sided with me. They stood behind my decision. And so we were able to maneuver them into building an extra large-sized helmet. But in fact, the way this happened was I got a phone call from the commanding general of the aviation branch, who told me that, you know, congratulations, Doc, you're going to get your extra large helmet. And I told him I thought that was good. It was necessary, you know, for the military. And he said, oh, and by the way, so-and-so will have a helmet fitted to him, and he will fly. And I was very pleased with that. So the guy that I had to kind of single out, he did get to fly eventually.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I had to go around the country, actually around the world. We went not only to all the bases in the United States, but we also went overseas to Korea. We went over to Germany as well, in order to measure the heads on the attack helicopter pilots to see who could transition to the aircraft before we got this extra large helmet size in. So we did several thousand of those. And all the guys that went to the first Gulf War flying the Apache, they were all hand-picked by my team so that they would be compatible with the system. But that was one thing. But that was the springboard to something else. When I went to England, I wanted to look more closely at helmet sizing. So I got involved with one of the mathematicians over there at the RAE, Andy Belly even. And we used the RAF database, which was very similar to the American database. And Andy comes to me and says, you know, something very interesting. The linear measurements of the head all select independently. There's no correlation. And immediately, I understood what that meant. There were no small, medium, or large heads. All of the linear measurements of the heads select without regard to the others. So it was all over the map. And that was a major breaking point. By doing multivariate analysis, Andy and I determined that you couldn't just use small, medium, and large. You had to have a central helmet in the mean of the distribution pattern for the eye height, the length, and the width of the head. And then you should build up a cube of eight other sizes around it in order to cover the largest number of people. We used it with several different helmet systems, not only the nine helmet system, but also a larger one which had 27 sizes, etc. And we determined mathematically that the nine helmet system was perfect. That was the one we should use. And we published this paper. You know, the RAE, Royal Aircraft Establishment, published it as one of their tech manuals. We also put it in Aviation, Space, and Environmental Medicine. And it immediately changed the way helmets were designed and used. First of all, in all the British forces, we also had that change in the U.S. Army. It eventually made its way to the Air Force, so the Air Force uses our helmet sizing scheme as well. And I know the Marine Corps has used it. The Navy, I'm not quite as sure of. The Navy is a very interesting procurement system. There's an Atlantic Fleet and a Pacific Fleet, and they do everything independently of each other. There's so much variation in Navy equipment that you can't really standardize it across the board. But I'm pretty sure, since the Army and the Air Force took it, the Navy couldn't be far behind, especially since their Marines were doing it as well. So we basically changed the way that helmets are designed and sized. And in the paper, I included some recommendations for generalizing the same multivariate analysis that we had used to designing other pieces of life support equipment, including flight suits and other articles of clothing. So it was a big breakthrough. It was a mathematical refiguring of how the human body is put together and how we should approach fitness.
That's quite a contribution, too. I'm sure the pilots are very thankful.
Oh, yeah, I know. It was kind of funny. One of my son's friends had gone to a flight training in the Air Force. He came back and he visited us, and he said, you know, we had this, you know, they had this very detailed fitting system for the helmets. I asked them what this was all about. They said it was something they got from the Army, and I had to laugh because that was me.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about your work with asbestos. Can you go into that in any detail?
Well, as I said, I was analyzing cases for the attorneys in our area in Illinois. Madison County, Illinois is one of the places that a lot of the asbestos cases are tried in. They bring suit there because it has a history of being relatively liberal with allowing for fault on the part of the company and paying out dollar amounts. So they really needed quite a few people doing that. And the main issue was that there's more than one type of asbestos. There is the amphibole asbestos, which is the one that causes mesothelioma, which is the real bad actor in this game. Then you have chrysotile asbestos, which is different. It doesn't cause mesothelioma, though it is associated with asbestosis and with lung cancer. And my job was to go through these cases, look at the history, and see whether or not there was a credible link between asbestos use and mesothelioma primarily. I did a few cases with regard to lung cancer as well, but asbestosis and mesothelioma were the two things that I mostly concentrated on. And I've testified in several cases. I've evaluated hundreds of cases. You know, when I'd evaluated, I would sometimes tell the attorneys, well, you know, I don't think you have much of a leg to stand on. This one appears clearly to have been caused by the occupational exposure. But in other cases, I had some interesting ones. One was a nuclear soldier who had developed mesothelioma. And he didn't have any credible asbestos exposures in his occupational life. But this particular guy had been there. With the nuclear soldiers, were back in the 1950s. They were doing training on the ground where they would explode tactical nuclear weapons from cannon shells mostly. And there were some handheld rocket ones that you could launch. You had to make sure it got far enough away so it didn't fall back on you. But these guys were going through these areas and were exposed to fallout and various other things. And it has been shown that they have a higher level of mesothelioma than other people. So this was one case where when I looked at it, I said, now this gentleman, his exposure to radioactive nuclides is probably the cause for his meso, not asbestos. There also have been some recent discoveries in the chemistry of the deserts here in the United States showing that we actually have zeolites here. Zeolites are a particular type of mineral that they have in Turkey, which is known to cause mesothelioma in patients. So it was interesting. You're trying to tease this apart. You've got to actually be a detective and link things up. I had some cases, some of these guys, during World War II, they were on board ship, and their bunk was underneath this pipe where the insulation kept generating dust, you know, that they inhaled when they went to sleep at night. And, you know, that was another case where the occupational exposure was not really the problem. It was the military exposure. And that's handled differently in the courts.
So aside from these medical mystery cases, what would you say is the standard method of establishing a link between asbestos and the related diseases? Is it as simple as just finding the material inside the lungs, or is there a more complicated process?
Well, you do need to show medical evidence of deposition of asbestos in the lung. About one case in three of mesothelioma has no connection to asbestos, and in some studies it goes as high as one case in two. So asbestos in and of itself is not the main bad actor here. There are other things that can do it. You've got to understand the type of asbestos that was involved. In some cases, these men were drywallers who used chrysotile asbestos, and chrysotile is not associated with mesothelioma. It is associated with other asbestos-related diseases, but not that one. And, you know, those were ones which, you know, scientifically, they could not have been caused by the asbestos exposure because of the type of asbestos involved. So you have to know that. You have to know the amount. You also have to know the natural history of the disease. I have had some cases where the normal incubation period for mesothelioma is about 50 years. So you've got to be pretty old before mesothelioma starts showing up. And I recently had a case to review of someone in their 40s who had developed an odd type of lung tumor. And the lung tumor looked like a non-small cell carcinoma of the lung, but when they started doing histologic staining, they said that there was a high probability that this was mesothelioma. Now, after looking at it, this guy wasn't old enough really to have mesothelioma caused by asbestos. The tumor itself presented as a mass in the lung, not in the pleural lining, which is also atypical for asbestos. There are the features of it that were just not right. There was no really good history of asbestos exposure and no clinical evidence of asbestos deposition in the lungs. So I think that was an interesting case. While the high probability was that it was a mesothelioma tumor, I think that it was so wildly undifferentiated that they really weren't able to make a case. And I think that while this may have appeared to be meso, I don't think it was. I think it was just a wildly undifferentiated carcinoma. And that's going to be a hard one to fight. Very likely, the court's not going to buy it. But I think from a clinical viewpoint, it's pretty clear to me that that case doesn't meet the typical pattern. And so I don't think it is meso.
So what are your goals in terms of your work at Aetna or your work as a researcher?
Well, at Aetna, I basically review cases in order to determine what would what we cover in terms of treatment and other options for patients. We also do disability evaluations and make recommendations on disposition for patients. We have a lot of elderly patients. The number of people over the age of 80 has skyrocketed in the last 10 years, and this is creating the need for some type of assisted living or custodial care for them. And right now, we don't have any very good system, either at the state or the federal level, for dealing with this problem. It is getting larger, and it's going to be a crisis, in the middle of the next decade. Something's got to give. And the important thing, the thing that I do is I go in to take a look at what is appropriate, what treatments are appropriate, and, try and match the coverage in our policy to what the doctors are requesting. Hopefully, our main goal at Aetna is to try and facilitate good health in our members to make sure they get what they need. And that, our new motto is, you don't join us, we join you. And so we have a very strong commitment to making sure that our members get the medical care that they need. And right now, we have so many new treatments that are just coming on board. You probably have seen a lot of commercials on TV for biologics like Humira and Remicade and that. Biologics are medications that alter the immune system's response, and they are very important in the treatment of cancer, in the treatment of collagen vascular diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis. They're used in infections as well. This is a burgeoning new area. It's exploded in the last 10 years, and there are so many of these different medicines. It is important to determine which ones are appropriate and which ones are not. And part of our job is to assist the providers in finding appropriate treatments for patients with some of these new medications.
Can you envision a day where you step aside from medicine and enter retirement fully, or is that something that doesn't interest you?
Well, at the moment, I'm feeling like I want to continue doing stuff. I think I have something to contribute. I've got a lot of experience both in the clinical end of things, in the emergency room end of things, in the scientific end of things. And at the moment, I don't have any immediate plans for retirement in the foreseeable future. Maybe in 10 or 15 years, we'll have to see.
You know, a lot of people in your field have the same opinion.
Yeah, it's kind of hard when you've been doing this kind of thing all your life. It's kind of hard not to continue working.
Thank you, Arthur, for taking the time out of your day to share your story with our listeners. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to Marquee Radio. Stay tuned for more in-depth and informative interviews with professionals from all walks of life.